Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 393, I have the pleasure of bringing you a preview of the June 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician can be found online and in print for free at retinalphysician.com. I'm joined by three of my colleagues to discuss this issue, which focused on oncology and uveitis. Hopefully you enjoy this, and again, you can look for a list of relevant financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also claim CME credits for this episode and many prior episodes by clicking on the link in the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Remember, they are no longer offering CME credits for current episodes. For prior episodes you may have listened to, you can claim credits there. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the June 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that you can find Retinal Physician online at retinalphysician.com. Joining me for this podcast, three of my friends from around the country. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Safa Rahmani from Chicago. Safa, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Next, we have Dr. Akshay Thomas from Nashville, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Priya Vakharia from Tampa.
Good to be back, Jay.
Safa, as a requisite, when I have Priya and Akshay on this podcast, you will have to answer questions about serial. Yeah, there you go. Akshay's got a serial killer t-shirt spelled the not creepy way versus the creepy way. Given that this is an audio format, Akshay, but we appreciate the visual joke internally here. So we have a bunch of articles. The theme for this month's issue was oncology and uveitis. And again, you can read these articles. We're not going to go through them in exhaustive detail. But the first article we can talk about, which I thought was interesting, was talking about radiation retinopathy. And it's very topical because I think as retina specialists, we do see these patients. I actually saw three of these patients today that I've been managing for a while. I think they sort of just get absorbed into our flow and you sort of forget you have them. But, you know, this was an article put together by Jonathan Sway with Brian Vanderbeek as the senior author. And they go through a few of the things. They go through the ways this can happen, the different sort of ways that this can affect the retina. And really, it's the capillary non-perfusion that can cause issues resulting in your complications, macular edema, envy, or hemorrhage. And so they talk about a few things. They talk about risk factors. I think that the diagnosis can be variable. They talk about different testing modalities, such as fluorescein, which can be used to diagnose this. But really, the history is what drives the diagnosis of this. And it has to be the history that makes sense. And then treatment. And I think treatment is where we'll kind of focus a lot of our discussion. They talk about the anti-VEGF treatment for macular edema from radiation retinopathy is shorter. There are some studies showing that even treatment with aflibercept, you may need treatment as often as 6 weeks, that you don't get the same sort of benefit for treat and extend. They also talk a little bit about how steroids, given that there is that limited ability to extend, that steroids may be helpful. However, it does seem to be a primarily VEGF-driven disease, and steroids may be more helpful as an adjunct. And then they talk about, you know, you can use panoramic laser or even vitrectomy if it came to, although that's unusual. And then one thing that was interesting, they talked a little bit about hyperbaric oxygen. I think most folks don't have access to, but it's an interesting thought in terms of improving vascular perfusion. We can talk about that concept a little bit. And really what they talk about was prevention. And prevention comes down to things that ocular oncologists talk about, reducing radiation exposure to healthy tissue. And then prophylactic treatment can reduce macular edema. If you have patients who are higher risk getting plaques for uveal melanoma, you start with injections early on. And then there's some authors who propose silicone oil tamponade to sort of reduce the exposure of the retina to radiation, although there are issues with metastasis once you put oil into a surgery in the eye. So there is an interesting protocol coming up. BRCR is doing a radiation retinopathy protocol, faricimab versus intravitreal fluocinolone versus observation to prevent radiation or acuity loss due to radiation retinopathy. That's protocol AL. And then we'll probably get more info as that study comes along. We'll kick it off here. So Safa, I thought for me, this is an overall, I think it's a very good review if people want to read it. I thought the thing that I take away from radiation retinopathy is I tell patients, number one, it is a little more resistant to treatment, although it does respond really well to anti-VEGF. But number two, these are patients who rarely stop treatment. I think that when I'm teaching, I kind of classify in my head the different things we inject for the big classes of diseases, AMD, DME, RVO, diabetic retinopathy, and here radiation retinopathy is a little more niche, but there's a different sort of frequency to A, how often you need to inject, and B, what are the chances that you can stop? And to me, that's one of the big takeaways for this is, unfortunately, because these radiation effects are longstanding, I feel you rarely can stop these patients. And I think the data sort of bears that out.
No, I agree. I think this article, although it's focused for oncology folks, is actually pretty applicable to any general retinal practice, because these patients will come along once they're done with oncology treatment. And it's important to keep in mind that it's not just, oh, they were treated for melanoma. This is all sorts of, you know, face and neck oncology that can cause radiation retinopathy, either inadvertently or, you know, knowingly that, you know, that was the best treatment for the patient. Majority of my patients are kids with various craniopharyngeal cancers that come through that needed radiation or whole body radiation or whole brain radiation. So it's really actually very applicable if these studies pan out to try to decrease the intervals and kind of try to prevent radiation retinopathy for these kids, is really important. So I think it's very applicable to all the treating retina specialists, because these patients will find your way. And the few that I have, I agree with you. I really can't stop treatments. The ones that I've had, because there were kids, a lot of them have the ischemic type more than the macular edema type. So lots of lasers. I'm the one that's had to do vitrectomy for radiation retinopathy. Oh, wow. One out of the 750, because they came in with an exudative detachment, you know. So all that can happen, and it's very applicable, and it's very, very difficult to treat. It's absolutely, you know, it's long term. It's, you know, similar to some of the recalcitrant AMD patients that just, they're going to be your patients for the long haul. So anything that we can do to extend interval and prevent, more importantly, is going to be very critical for these patients.
That brings up the interesting question, Priya, about hyperbaric oxygen. I'm curious. I've heard patients ask me about this, especially in the setting of RVO, and there's some limited data out there. Any thoughts? I mean, again, it's not really something that a retina specialist could have like in their office, like, oh, hop in my hyperbaric oxygen chamber and you'll feel so much better. For me, it's RVO and radiation retinopathy. Radiation, they're not exactly the same, but I believe like it's almost like a souped up multiple BRVO, right? The way it behaves. I think wet AMD, I know it's frustrating for patients that they have to keep getting treatment, but it makes some implicit sense because of the degenerative component with the RPE, that you do end up the structural issue, but also this chronic inflammation that's been borne out with the efficacy of anti-inflammatory treatment for dry AMD. DME, you know, systemic disease. Systemic control plays a big role. You use your injections, things like that, but the systemic issue. But RVO, I mean, RVO patients are sometimes the most befuddled, right? They're the patients who are like, this thing happened to me like 8 years ago. I've been fine ever since. No one can ever explain to me why it happened in the first place. I'm not hypertensive for some of these patients. Something just happened. And you get an angiogram on me and my perfusion is fine. So why does this keep happening? And last time we did a podcast, we were talking about venous pressure. And one of the ideas was modulating that. So that's where the hyperbaric oxygen thing is interesting. Have you had any patients ask about this? Have you thought about this at all? Have you any experience? I know you've got some innovators like David Eichenbaum around you who like talk about stuff like this.
Yeah. So we haven't used hyperbaric oxygen in Tampa. The only exposure I've had to it is I think they're using it for concussion patients. There's like a big concussion center here in Tampa, and there is a hyperbaric oxygen. And I'll admit, when, you know, sometimes we have concussion patients that show up in clinic, you know, for various reasons, flashes and floaters. And I always kind of look at it and say, oh, that's interesting. Like I never really thought it was a thing. I thought it was maybe just a fad, but you know, I think it makes sense, right? Hyperbaric oxygen in theory causes vasodilation, especially of the venules, and maybe improves perfusion to the far peripheral retina. So I don't know, you know, I think maybe we should be sending patients to this hyperbaric oxygen chamber. I'm going to tell David, we have a new study in Tampa Bay, piloting hyperbaric oxygen with RVOs and what happens. But I mean, I think the premise makes sense. I don't have any experience with it though.
I mean, if you want fad treatment, speaking as a native Floridian, the place to go for fad health treatments is Florida, for better or for worse. I mean, just looking at briefly, the first hit when you Google hyperbaric chamber cost is a therapy center in Florida for me, obviously is Googling this from Florida. You can prepay and get 20 treatments for $120 each, which is a great discount. So it wouldn't be an expensive study to run, David Eichenbaum, if you're listening somewhere. I'm just telling you, it probably, you know, probably could pay for that somewhere out of the car fund. So Akshay, radiation retinopathy, this protocol that was then designed, I always thought it was fascinating when I talked to people why fluocinolone is the comparative, right? So I think the idea is they picked quote unquote the best or the most durable anti-VEGF versus the most durable steroid versus nothing, right? Which is an interesting concept. I'd be curious how efficacious ILUVIEN is, because there's actually no indication for ILUVIEN or YUTIQ for RVO. And this is off label already. I appreciate them trying to expand the label. You know, we got news this last week, we're recording this, May 22nd, there was news that, you know, Alimera has acquired YUTIQ rights from EyePoint. It's interesting to kind of search and hunt for another indication, but it is interesting because I have a lot of RVO patients who respond really well to steroids long-term, and it's good for extending. I think that's actually a very hidden good place for intravitreal steroid. I know your uveitis specialist, that's where your uveitis threshold, CME from uveitis is where you put your intravitreal steroids, but RVO almost more than DME, because those patients, again, are chronically getting injected. It'd be interesting to see if this bears out for RR too, because we don't have a 3-year steroid option for RVO.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's, I don't know what the exact protocol is in terms of like timing, if these patients are getting it, you know, at first evidence of actual radiation retinopathy, just knowing kind of the time from, you know, plaque exposure to onset, or if they're having it, you know, very close post-surgery, but that'll be very interesting. I'm also very curious in general, because, you know, an irradiated angle or an angle that's been close to radiation, I don't know how, whether it's more likely to get a steroid response, you know, than a regular eye. So I'm just curious to see kind of what their pressure response is going to be, whether it's being comparable to like a diabetic patient or very much unlike that in terms of what percentage of patients are getting a meaningful kind of steroid response, so to speak.
That's an interesting point. And also you're accounting that also for the radiation effects on the trabecular mesh for speculitis you get, right? It's interesting. Maybe more like the uveitic patient.
Yep, that's right. And that's why I'm curious. I wonder in the protocol if they're going to get some way, shape or form of a quote unquote steroid challenge. I think that's one thing I always grapple with before reaching for any, whether it's your diabetic patient or your uveitic patient, one, making sure they get a treatment response to a steroid. There's some strange diseases where sometimes they get less of a steroid response in terms of treatment effect than you would have expected, but also just what their pressure does, right? You can be really caught off guard when you get give a dexamethasone implant, someone gets a pressure of 40 or 50. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how it bears out.
Yeah, I think the protocol patient selection is going to be absolutely critical here, probably more than many other trials, because, you know, how are they going to stratify the high risk? How are they going to stratify, you know, all that has to be sort of balanced. So it'll be interesting to see how they're going to do that.
Yeah, you know, again, and I apologize for not being prepared. I'm trying to track down that protocol. If you go to DRCR website, there's not open information on it at this point. So hopefully we'll get some more news as we move forward on what exactly that construction design is going to be like. Well, let's talk about this next article and keeping kind of the ocular oncology discussion. There is an article about new treatments for ocular melanoma. Basil Williams and Mauro Di Nicola, friends of the podcast, were authors on this with Bria George. They talk about therapeutic approaches, subtitled currently clinical trials may provide novel alternatives with fewer side effects than brachytherapy or proton beam radiotherapy. And look, we just talked about one of the major side effects of radiation. Obviously, it's much better than enucleation. We're always trying to get better, but there are disadvantages. And they talk a little bit about the disadvantage of radiation retinopathy or optic neuropathy. And the percentage is kind of staggering. They talk about nearly half these patients end up with 20/200 vision or worse, which is, again, you're saving life and then you're saving an eye. But now the third kind of priority is, could you preserve more vision? So they talk about some of the things that could be ideas. And again, I won't recap all the different molecules they're looking at, but there are different sort of approaches, including they talk about new drug treatments that include delivering the suprachoroidal space or intravitreal injection. There's a discussion about metastasis. There is the first FDA-approved medication to treat metastatic uveal melanoma. Good for all ophthalmologists kind of know about, which is tebentafusp, which is Kimmtrak. And that is a bispecific fusion protein that is anti-CD3 and also gets GP100 as a target. And then it's the only FDA-approved medication on the market. There are many other trials and approaches. Then they talk finally the genetic approach, which is always interesting to talk about sort of things that could modulate genetics. And that's why they talked about some of the trials that are looking at combos of nivolumab and relatlimab. And it's a take home, I guess, if I had to summarize this article, there is a lot of work being done. I think that we don't hear about this at our standard retina meetings, but this is actually a big sort of thing, is we're always thinking for every condition, okay, you saved a life. For most of us, that's not an issue for eye conditions, but you saved a life. Number two, saved an eye. Number three, how much vision did you get back? Priya, I'll ask you first. You know, I think that one of the big things that comes up, and I see it come up a lot for these patients, and again, none of us are ocular oncologists, or again, apologies to those out there who are ocular oncologists listening, but I think there are a lot of retina specialists out there who have to take care of these patients kind of on their own. It's becoming less and less common as more ocular oncologists come up, but it's probably worth just from a, I feel like this is the part of ASRS or Academy sub day where most of the room filters out of the room and takes a coffee break. It's uveitis oncology. Sorry, Akshay. But it's probably the part of the meeting the most important and relevant, right? Because this is one of the few things similar to uveitis conditions where this patient could actually die if you mishandle the situation. And then what you choose ultimately, you can't undo. So if you decide, if you're a retina specialist out in the middle of nowhere and you plaque that patient, yes, you save their life and you may save their eye, but if there's a better option or trial out there, it's probably a good idea to kind of be in touch with somebody who has access to those trials and is able to connect you. So I just think it's interesting as someone who's like involved in meeting planning organization that probably isn't a bad idea to have a good repository of these available, because the vast majority of ocular melanomas don't present to ocular oncologists. They're going to show up referred to retina specialists.
No, I mean, I completely agree, Jay. And I think for the average retina specialist too, the reason this is also pertinent is maybe many of us are not plaqueing or doing the treatments, but we're the ones that are referring patients. And I don't know, perhaps some of us are watching these patients for too long. Perhaps we should recognize that plaques have certain limits and that other things have certain limits. And, you know, I think in general, it's good to be knowledgeable. This is not specifically for ocular oncology, but now there's so many new medications in the general oncology realm. Sometimes I have a patient that comes in and I have to have them spell out their drug because I honestly have no idea what they're taking. And I think that as an ophthalmologist, we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our ocular oncology colleagues to at least be knowledgeable about what the patient is getting and understand what the side effects are. And as you said, we have amazing ocular oncologists, but oftentimes these patients travel really far to see those ocular oncologists. And so those ocular oncologists have to partner with a local retina specialist and rely on them to monitor for other side effects that can happen.
Yeah, and I'm going to tie it before I get Sophie with us. This next article is about RB. It's Simple Guide to Treating Retinoblastoma by Vishal Raval, Stacey Zoller, and Arun Singh from Cleveland Clinic. And again, I'm not going to go through an exhaustive detail, but if I had to summarize this article, there's a couple of really good tables that if you have access to Retinal Physician, which we all do because it's free, you should go read them. And I think filing away these tables and knowing kind of, at least from, I'm sure this is a gross simplification, but it's actually really helpful for me as someone who doesn't treat RB to be and hasn't seen an RB patient in a long time to say, okay, like depending on which compartment the eye is involved, what are kind of the best options in terms of chemo, intravenous, systemic, intraarterial, or intravitreal? Because it wasn't as complicated 40 years ago. But right now there's actually a ton of options. I know this is an area of extensive debate and controversy. But again, this is a bigger issue. And this is even a bigger issue, Safa, because you're as a pediatric retina specialist, these kids aren't deciding for themselves. This is their parents and you. And it's really tough to convince any parent to remove a child's eye, which ultimately may be necessary in some cases to save their life. So that's why there's been such a push for more and more globe salvaging procedures. We haven't really moved into vision saving, right? And gone that hierarchy, but moving from, okay, I can save your kid's life and I can save your kid's eye potentially. You know, this is sort of why I think there's been such a push to come up with better options as it was outlined here.
No, absolutely. I actually do treat a lot of the more complex retinoblastomas, whether I want to or not. I'm the only one. and this is a really good article that kind of just breaks everything down in an easily digestible way, because again, these patients present to the local pediatrician, they present to the pediatric ophthalmologist and sort of work their way up. And thankfully, you know, most people know, you know, to when there's a concern to refer, but there's still people that come through, you know, from many hours away that need treatment. And these discussions actually become really important. And the importance of what you said in terms of the quality of life that a child will have after a enucleation, say from a, you know, group E exam, for example, that we could potentially treat and potentially save the globe. They're going to have multiple exams under anesthesia, multiple sessions, maybe some success, you know, complete disruption of family life. And, you know, to sort of to what avail, we've had, you know, quite a bit of these patients where, you know, in hindsight, you're like, maybe we should have offered enucleation, you know, and at least none of the patients that we've had that eventually had to go to enucleation have regretted it, because these kids bounce back so quickly. They get their prosthesis and they move on with their life. You know, it's not a 2 or 3 year prolonged and never. I'm not advocating for enucleation, but I think the conversation needs to be had. And I'm lucky I'm in a center that we have everything available. So the option of, do we do IAC? Do we do, you know, chemo? We work closely. We have like two oncologists that do RB just like as a main practice. So we have, you know, we're sort of very lucky that we're able to basically offer any combination that we think is going to be beneficial for the patient. Again, life first and eye second, and the majority of patients do really well. So I think it's important to know where you're referring to and what options are going to be offered. And that's exactly why I think this disease in the United States is 95 to 100% treatable, and not so much in other parts of the world, which is why I think there's still focus as to how can we treat this disease, because, you know, we're sort of like, woo, we've got this, you know, we've got these treatments and it's working really well. Yes, you can tweak them, but most of the world doesn't have a lot of these options. And it's the more that we can deliver things that are more effective is going to be better for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic overview. And I think that the part that you highlighted that you pointed out here was also the cost-effective nature. That yes, we're excited that US is so successful, but they really highlighted these chemo options are very expensive. The preparations are expensive. It's not easy. The requirements to give them are not optimal, which means there still needs to be a better way to do this. And then we'll segue, because Akshay is just like hankering at the bit. He's like chomping. He's waiting to get to this last article. This is an article by Shruthi Arupalli, a current clinical trials in uveitis. This is what Akshay Lee reads before he goes to bed every night. And so I think maybe he doesn't, maybe that laugh. I can't tell if that laugh was sarcastic or agreeable. So she does a good job going through each of the phases of uveitis trials. And again, I'm not going to go through this in exhaustive detail. This is essentially a beautiful summary, paragraph by paragraph, going through every single trial that's out there. Again, a remarkable amount that maybe I'm just not paying close enough attention. I feel like I try to read and keep up, but I don't know if Priya, Sophie, you agree, like way more going on in the late phases than I was aware of, even phase four trials, a bunch of them going on. So I will just say as a conclusion, if I had to take a take home from this, there's going to be a lot of treatment options in about 5 years. And I suggest you go read this. Not all these phase three options are going to pan out or change everyone's life, but uveitis is not always just going to be give some steroids, throw some steroids, and if that doesn't work, try, you know, CellCept. You know, there's going to be a lot more options for uveitis patients. Priya, you're laughing, but you know that is what a lot of people think uveitis is. It isn't. I mean, there are many things. Akshay, which of these trials are you the most excited for as a uveitis specialist? Which is going to change your day-to-day the most? And if you have disclosures, please say them. But like,
yes, I will.
I don't want you to try to hike someone's stock price and sell tomorrow. So go ahead.
So there's the one that I'm actually most excited about are a couple that are not on this article yet, but maybe will be in the next iteration. So one is through Roche. They're working on and one that we're in trial now.
Did Shruthi really give you 40 something uveitis trial options and you picked number 44 off the menu? This is like going to the Cheesecake Factory and ordering something that's not on their menu.
No, I'm going to order something. But one is obviously, you know, a thing that we all struggle with as retina specialists is inflammatory CME. And a lot of our systemic therapeutics are often not effective at managing that CME. So often you're doing a systemic immunosuppressive plus something for their CME. And so there's a intravitreal IL-6 inhibitor that's being worked on through Roche. You know, systemic IL-6 inhibitors are very good at treating CME and retinal vasculitis. And if we have a new intravitreal therapeutic, which doesn't induce a steroid response or a cataract yet to be seen, to be determined, that would be very, very exciting and kind of a game changer, because every therapeutic we right now have is local therapy for CME are all steroids, right? So especially in our young patients, if we can inject something that doesn't cause a cataract and is maybe even more durable than a steroid, again, to be determined, that's very exciting. And I'd say the other things which are very exciting are there's a couple of trials, one through Priovant, one through Illumis, which are looking at TYK2 inhibitors, which have potentially less side effects than a lot of our immunosuppressive. So again, if we have very effective therapeutics, but if we can find something with less side effects, that'd be great. So I'm very excited about those two as well.
So Farapriya, do you have any questions for Akshay? Because I'm just blinded by his intelligence right now.
I think this highlights the importance of why during subspecial day, you should not skip out on humans.
No, I mean, if you're going to pay whatever that crazy price is, whatever, $1,000, whatever, you should go to everything. Like, and I know it's tempting, but it's probably higher yield, again, for average person who doesn't have someone across the street in academics to refer these patients to. It's probably way higher yield to go to these docs. And I think most of the folks know that. I mean, the people who are taking care of these patients out, again, the average uveitis patient actually probably does not go and see a uveitis specialist for the first 3 or 4 visits they see a retina specialist at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of want to briefly just cycle back to the retinoblastoma article I promised to point to, which is that, you know, we will all see far more children with intermediate uveitis during your career as a retina specialist than you will retinoblastoma. And the worst thing you can miss would be something you think is intermediate uveitis, but it's actually retinoblastoma. And, you know, in my career, I've had only one of those children that I was like, I saw them in the clinic, I couldn't get a good exam. I was like, I'm going to take them for an exam under anesthesia because I can just definitively say that this is an intermediate uveitis and they had retinoblastoma. So, you know, when in doubt, don't forget that one of the masquerades for intermediate uveitis is actually retinoblastoma, especially, you know, the type with tons of vitreous seeding or even the one with diffuse subretinal seeds. It can just look like florid intermediate uveitis. So just a heads up.
I think I just peed myself a little. That sounds really scary. Well, guys, I really appreciate you taking the time. Akshay Thomas, if you like uveitis, Headlight in the Fog, the uveitis podcast he hosts, way more intellectual than this podcast, but thanks for sharing. Safa, before we go, what's your favorite cereal of all time?
Ah, man. I'm going to have to go with...
You can do it with milk and without milk if you want.
Then I got to go with the Lucky Charms marshmallows.
You can buy those.
I did get a discussion about this.
You can buy the marshmallows separately. I found that out like 2 years ago. If I had known that as a child, my life would have been so different.
So sorry, you're letting your kids have that now, right? You're gonna literally give them the childhood you didn't have.
The key of, I'm not a parent yet, but it seems the key, all three of your parents, to being a good parent is to give your kids none of the, or don't give your kids the things that you would have wanted as a kid.
Absolutely. For the most part. they'll find it eventually themselves. That's the goal. As long as they're under my command, they will find it, and then they'll find it on their own and can enjoy it on their own.
Guys, enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks to our doctors for joining us today. Thanks again to our whole production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benacasa. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you're going to publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of on a daily basis. Remember, you can find all of our episodes online at retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. Looking forward to hearing from you and looking forward to next week's episode. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.